around for a long celebration season. The topic for this session is the Great Depression. I might start by saying a little bit about the term itself. While the word depression has been around for a long time, it wasn't the most common term back in those days. The term that was typically used was panic. It was in the panic of 07, the panic in the end of the last century. Of course, panic scares people. But no one could look forward to a panic. It just sounds awful. And when the economy started this downturn in late 29 and the end of the 30s, the term that was favored was depression, which, if you think of it out of context, doesn't sound too bad. A depression is something that a softball does to the hood of your car when it comes over the fence. It's just a depression. Nothing to worry about, of course, unless you just bought the car yesterday or something. But that's a depression. Don't worry about it. It's a depression. Well, of course, what happened was just god-awful. 10 years was a depression, 25% unemployment. And so that term took on worse of meaning, yes. I think this microphone is just connected to a recording, so I'll have to turn it up here back. But I can do it. So, anyhow, depression took on the meaning of the Great Depression. It was capital D, capital D, depression. It's a proper noun. And in subsequent years, and there's another chapter to that story, because in the 1950s, during the Eisenhower years, people were worried about God and another depression, you know, with all the awful connotations of that. And they were told, nothing like that, just a recession. Which doesn't sound so bad. Everybody likes recess, you know, we're just sort of taking some time off and we'll get back at it, so don't worry about the recession. Well, it was sure enough in the late 50s, 58, 59, the downturn didn't last long, wasn't too deep, and so since then, the terms have taken on the connotation of one being worse than the other. Recession, not so bad, depression, god awful, okay? So it just sort of squares the terms with the way we talk about these things. In later years, there was an attempt, let me think of who made it, I think it was Jim Baker of the Nixon administration, who suggested, it was Alfred Kahn. Alfred Kahn, that was Carter's economic advisor. When the economy was starting to turn down again, people were worried, are we going into another recession? And he said, no, it's a sideways walking. That was his term. Now, that just didn't catch on, I'm sorry. It just didn't work. And so that term is sort of lost to history. You might think that this topic is the same as the topic of business cycles, but for the obvious, it really isn't. The issue of cyclical behavior on the one hand, and the god-awful Great Depression, the 10 years of bad things in the 30s, are connected. They're certainly connected historically and even causally, but they're not the same topic, and let me make the point. If you look at my graphical expositions in the last couple of days, what you saw is that the focus was on the unsustainable boom that preceded the Great Depression in the 1920s. A boom that was stimulated by monetary growth, credit expansion, that couldn't last. It was inherently unsustainable, and eventually gave rise to a downturn, which started in 29. And so the Austrian theory of the business cycle really is a theory of the unsustainable boom. It's a theory that shows why credit-induced boom can't be sustained. It's got to turn sour at the end, which it turns out it does. And in fact, that business of the downturn growing out of the boom itself is what gives the cycle its cyclical quality. As we say in economics, it's an endogenous turning point. There's different ways to say it. You can say the boom is inherently unsustainable, it's going to come undone. That there's a self-reversing process. In other words, resources are allocated towards early stage production, but at the end of the boom, they're reallocated in the other direction because of increasing scarcity in other parts of the structure of production. Or it's a process that contains the seeds of its own undoing. It's another way of saying the same thing. But it's going to come undone. It's not going to work. You can't have a permanent boom or genuine growth out of credit expansion. So it's a theory of the unsustainable boom. The upper turning point is endogenous. Now, the authors don't argue that both turning points are exactly endogenous. In other words, there's nothing in the nature of markets that causes a downturn to turn into an upturn. Okay? You get the downturn, and then you get eventually recovery from that. But nothing to suggest that leads to still another unsustainable boom. Okay? So you don't get what I like to call econo-rhythms. There's nothing inherent about the market that will give you econo-rhythms up and down. As, say, the Marxists would argue. Marxism says it's inherent in the nature of capitalism that you get booms and busts in this increasing magnitude until the whole thing collapses. That, of course, is not at all the Austrian theory. In modern theory, modern economic theory, that gets caught everywhere, they tend not to think of endogenous turning points at all. They think in terms of shocks, depending on upper level forces or even in some of the principal forces. They talk about there's some kind of a shock. It could be a supply shock or a demand shock or a monetary shock. And a shock, it could send the economy down or send the economy up. And I've learned to see that shock word for what it is. It's a way of the economist saying something happened and we're not quite sure what. But it led to good things if it was a positive shock or bad things if it was a negative shock. I remember at a recent interview trip where I was interviewing people to see who we might have been hired at Auburn, I asked a question that was thought of as sort of an inappropriate question. I was prison and macroeconomist, and I said, well, what do you think caused the Great Depression? And the guy had to ask me to repeat the question. He had never heard this before. The question, that is, you never heard the question before. Well, what do you think caused the Great Depression? And he said, well, the negative shock. And that's as far as he could take it. And the rest of it was just the empirics and so on. So the authors reject shock theory in talking terms of the unsustainable boom. I want to show you just a short PowerPoint, mainly to drive the point home that I've already made. I'm not sure you can see it very well. I'm glad I'm not going to show very much in this history. It's going to go item in the book, so I will see it in a minute. But the distinction I want to make there is between the discussion of the unsustainable boom of has to lead to a downturn, and then the other discussion of what follows the downturn. In other words, how deep is it likely to be, and how long lasting is it likely to be? And of course, for the Great Depression, it was very, very deep. It was 25% unemployment. It was very, very long. It was 10 years. What accounts for that? What accounts for it being taking that long to recover? And that's quite a different question. The Austrian theory doesn't suggest that it would take that long to recover at all. Okay. And so if it took that long to recover, there must have been funny things happening along the way. It turns out it was an enormously bad, disconnected policy along the way. But that's not part of the Austrian theory of the business cycle. That's really macroeconomic history of the 1930s. It has much more of a historical tone than a theoretical tone, because it's history in the ultimate sense of the word. A historian once told me that history was just one damn thing after another. And that's certainly true during the 30s. You can't draw a set of graphics to show just what went on in the city. You just have to itemize all of the things that made the situation worse and kept the economy from recovering as it otherwise would have done. I'll show you why this is an important distinction, but let me run this show first. This is an attempt I made several years ago to get the students to focus on the real factors. Chris Mossop, in describing Hayek's theory, he says monetary factors cause the cycle. In other words, pumping credit through credit markets driving interest rates down. Monetary factors cause the cycle, but real factors constitute the cycle. In other words, real resources get misallocated in ways that are not going to work out and have to be undone. So I'm trying to get the student to focus attention on the real factors. And I do it actually by moving the setting, often kind of productive, but it works, moving the setting away from the monetary economy for the time being and to a command economy like the old Soviet Union. If I can, okay? Let's see if you can see this on the screen. I hope you can. A few things for right now, I think you can read it. So we're using an old Soviet style brickyard. It's got no markets, no prices. It's just cheaper of the bricks, and it's run by some flunky called Ivan. We have a housing czar, which really is a resource czar. It's whoever's in charge of allocating resources in the Soviet Union. Then he decides how many houses he needs to decide how many houses can be built, and so he sends Ivan to the brickyard to count the bricks. This is Soviet style economics. And we get Ivan's count, which is over and optimistic, which is also true to the old Soviet economy, that people like to please their boss, and they might overestimate how many bricks. He says enough to build 6 houses, maybe 5 would have been more realistic. And 6 houses in the old Soviet Union would be quite a housing boom, so we'll see how that goes. Okay. So the housing czar informs, I call him the master builder, I'm getting this from Mises, I'll show you in a minute. So he then sets the workers to the task, 2 rows of 3 houses each, do the math, that's 6 houses, okay. Let's take a look at what's going on. The wonders of the internet. You can do Google and search around and find the old Soviet brickyard. First I want to give you a quote from Mises and show how he sums it up. And here, for reasons I don't claim that he's the term master builder, this might be the translation from the German edition, I don't know. He says, consider the position of a master builder whose task it is to erect a building out of a limited supply of material. So he's got one building, okay, I've got 6. And he says, if a man overestimates the quantity of the available supply, he drafts a plan that cannot be carried out to completion because the means at his disposal are not sufficient. So that's the idea of the business cycle. You start too big. You start too early and too big in aiming at future consumption and run out of resources before you finish. He oversizes the groundwork and the foundation and only discovers later in the process of construction that he lacks the materials needed for the completion of the structure. He goes on to say it's obvious that his fault is not overinvestment, but an inappropriate employment of the means of his disposal. He calls it malinvestment. Okay, that's from Human Action. Now we go to the old Soviet-style brickyard. And there it is. Okay, I don't know if you can read Russian, but it says brickyard. You see the Kremlin in the background, and you've got the Soviet flag. That's it. Okay. Just by the edict of the Tsar, we're going to build 6,000. We signed it. Okay, we got 6 buildings. I guess they're not master buildings, they're 6 buildings. And they're building the houses. They have different styles of building, you know, they all look the same. But they're drawing from the same pile of bricks. As you can see, they draw down the bricks. Of course, the question is, are they going to get the housing finished before they run out of bricks? Are you worried? Okay. And of course, if Ivan said there were enough bricks to build 6, it might actually be a problem. Keep going. Better check back. Now you're getting worried, okay? You're not going to work out. I think I'm harder than I thought. More than one use of the cloud, then, yes? Okay, so now you run out of bricks. Because that was the boom. That was the artificial boom. But it's doomed to go bust because there aren't enough resources to complete all the projects that were finished. And I think I put a little query in here just to bring it back to reality for you. Would it help to put more money? Okay. This is what micromanaging. Bureaucracy constitutes a real problem. It's not solved by slapping dreams on paper. So what you have to do, of course, is liquidate. You have to liquidate at some of the project in order to finish the rest. And actually, you might think you only have to liquidate one of the houses and finish the other, because it wouldn't work to build five, isn't that right? But when you liquidate, you break a bunch of bricks. That's the way liquidation goes in the industrial sector of the economy. You break a bunch of bricks. So you have to liquidate two houses to end up with enough unbroken bricks that you can finish the other four. The two are what pop on either side, look about right there, and they go, okay, so you liquidate those, you've got a pile of bricks, some of them are worth using again, and you can fix, you can make the other houses. And so what we have here is the whole scenario. Five houses could have been built, had the master builder set out to build this five, but he's trying to build six. He was forcing liquidation just now, however, on the lack of sufficient resources. Given the losses, that's the broken bricks, but all these certain liquidation, the master builder, in the end, can only complete four houses. And there you have it. You've got boom, bust, liquidation, and partial recovery. You only get back to five houses, you only got four. Which is why, among other reasons, the Austrians, they're against cycles. They don't ignite an artificial boom. Now it might look good, but it'll go bust, and you won't quite get back to the growth path you would have been on if you not had the boom bust sequence to start with. Now, that sounds so obvious once you sort of understand how cycles go, but it's at odds with the common belief. In fact, none other than Ben Bernanke says that in that term, these bones are good. And so he hesitates to do anything to keep booms from materializing, which of course they do if you have an interest rate too low. And in fact, the way he says it is memorable. Bernanke says, "'Tis better to have boomed and busted than never to have boomed at all." Because I can say, no, Ben. You know, you'd be better off had you just maintained the growth path that was sustainable. You have five houses. See? Now, just briefly to link this up with what I've been talking about in the last couple of days, can you see that supply and demand is with a given supply of bricks, vertical? If we'd let the price system work here, rather than have items, we would at least start it out building the right number of houses. That's what this tells you down here. We don't need to read it. And if we'd let the supply of bricks also be governed by the market, how many bricks we're going to produce, getting upward sloping supply, then we could make adjustments on both sides, supply and demand. That's what this says, you don't need to read it. And now, here's the critical point. If the bricks in this little parable represent resources as a whole. It's just the economy's resources as a whole domain. And I'm representing it now with the financial wherewithal to take command over those resources for building houses or whatever. Oh. So I put investment and trading on the horizontal axis, and I put the letter I on the vertical axis. I hope you all know what I stands for. Okay? And I'm sure you're thinking of an interest rate. But of course, it stands for Ivan. Ivan. That's Ivan. Ivan, it's Ivan you're counting on to tell you the truth about how many projects you can begin to undertake. And if Ivan told me, well, how do you want to undertake the wrong number of projects? Okay. So having Ivan tell a lie is the same thing as having the interest rate too low. Interest rates telling a lie and saying that there's more resources available for production than actually exists. I say it on over here, yeah, I stand for Ivan, which is the interest rate. Okay. Now, I'll just show you very briefly, because we've done this before, that if people actually decide to save more, like so, shift to the right, then there's going to be more bricks, because people aren't consuming, they're freeing up resources to be used to expand the capital structure of the economy. So that's what gives you sustainable growth. And then I want to show you the categorical difference between that and the situation where nobody's saving anymore, but a policymaker is in play, and the policymaker makes the judgment that we need lower interest rates. You can tell us in a while when I made this video, because the policymaker is the room. Kind of picture into a lengthy in there, I guess. And with him, he gives us an increase in the money supply, which is a lie, which is an interest rate, because if there are now more resources to undertake investment projects, then in fact there are less, because with the low interest rate, people are going to save less. Okay? And that's what gives you the boom and bust. It drives the wedge between saving and investment and gives you the boom and bust. Okay? And that's what this story says. You don't need to read it. Okay? Now, the thing I want to emphasize for this lecture is that theory is about why the bust has to happen. Okay? It's not a theory that says how deep it will be or how long it will be. And those two questions, how deep and how long, have to be answered by more explanation in terms of the particular history of the downturn. Let me put this in context so you see why it's a live issue in academics today. Separating the issues. What causes the good times to go bad? And I think that's, to me, that's the root question. That's sort of the ground zero question. How does a boom turn sour? Well, because it was triggered by credit expansion and contained the seed of the boom undoing. That's the Austrian theory. And then the question that I consider a considering question is, why are the bad times so awfully bad in the case of the Great Depression? Now, in part, since is it considered, certainly in getting the theory straight of what accounts for the boom and bust, it's considering. In terms of just raw suffering, hunger, you know, unemployment and so on, hard times that people endured, from a historian's point of view, it's, you're know, more likely to look at the depth and length of the depression than to try to figure out what caused it in the first place. But as it turns out, almost all economists, apart from the authors, focus on this second question. And here's a question answer in an interview that I, in a book, Randall Parker wrote the book, and he interviewed economists who had lived through the Great Depression. And he's asking a question to Mortimer Adler, I think. He says, what was the initial impetus for the Great Depression and how it accounts for its depth? Okay. Now, Mortimer Adler's answer is revealing in more ways than one. He says, I don't know what the initial impetus was, and I can't account for how deep it was. Okay, he's talking about it. But except to say that the second question is much more important than the first. What makes it more important, you know? You can say, our people were hungry for a long time, you know, and if we have any sympathy for these people, we might think it's more important. But certainly to understand deep disciple theory, it's the first question that counts. Okay, now one thing I've learned in reading literature, especially monetarist literature, is that monetarists in particular downplay the issue of what caused the downturn in the first place. That's not their issue. And it's not their issue because their empirical research techniques won't show them. They haven't done any kind of empirical analysis that would suggest what caused the downturn. their empirical analysis is all in terms of the length and depth of the Great Depression, measuring unemployment for the whole 10 years, okay, and correlating it with other things that were going on at the time to try to find out why it was so deep. And so, when they even mention the downturn, which they think, and not in saying this case, it probably wouldn't have been very deep if it hadn't been for all these perverse policies. And they had a certain way of referring to it. I want to sensitize you to in case you're reading some of this literature. They say, well, in 29 there was just having an ordinary recession. Ordinary, you know, what's the... Surely the macroeconomist needs to account about why we could have a recession at all. They call it sometimes a routine recession. I don't know what this is. More terms, a run-of-the-mill recession. Which is all a way of saying, don't ask us what caused the thing, it was just an ordinary one, you know. Or last, a garden variety recession. I see that term quite often. And they say that almost under their breath, in order not to focus too much attention on this phenomenon, so that they can deal with the real problem of why it was so deep and why it was so long. Okay. And they're pretty bold about this. This is manufactured quote, but I can find lots of variations. The real question in this view, what accounts for the length and depth of the Great Depression? And by the way, they reject the Austrian view on these grounds. In other words, the Austrian view can't possibly account for the extreme depth, 25% unemployment, and extreme length, 10 years. And the Great Depression, therefore, so much for the Austrian theory. You see? That's what makes it critical, that the Austrian theory just gets blown off because they can't answer this question that the monarchists and others consider to be the real question. Alright? Well, I think that's significant. Now, I have to mention that the Austrians, in some ways, have contributed to the confusion about just what their topic is. In terms of saying the boom on the one hand, that's the basic cycle theory, and the depth and length of the depression, which is a historical question. And I'll mention two book titles, one by Lionel Robbins, 1934, where he wrote a book supporting Hayek and offering some supporting Hayek, the Hayekian theory of the cycle, and offering some empirical verification for it. But he called the book The Great Depression. Okay? And his topic wasn't really the whole of the Great Depression. In fact, he wrote the book in 1934, and he only dealt with ongoings up to about 1933. So the Depression hadn't even quite bottomed out yet. He didn't know how deep it was going to be or how long it was going to be. But he called the book The Great Depression. Years later, Murray Rothbard in 1963, so 30 years after it bottomed out, he wrote a book explaining the Austrian theory and the whole theoretical part about the unsustainable boom, but what was the title of his book? America's Great Depression. Okay? And yet, Rothbard, writing in 63, ends his analysis in 33, when the Depression is still a year away from bottoming out, let alone from getting out of the Depression in 39 or so. Right? So the Austrians have contributed some to the confusion. Another thing they make that contributes to this confusion, but shouldn't, because the people twist it into the logical implication, that is that you can find instances where I know Rothbard, for instance, and Hayek, and possibly others. I think Mises, I haven't found the particular site, but when they say, well, the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. Well, that's true. That's true in the sense that the more you misallocate resources intertemporally over a longer period of time, then the more time and the more severe the liquidation process is going to be. You've got to break a lot of breaks. to get back to normal. So in that sense, it's true that the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. But what's not true is that the actual depth and actual length of any depression is explained entirely in terms of the misallocation that preceded it. In other words, we can't say, well, 25% unemployment and 10 years of depression. That must be explained by horrendous misallocation during the boom to give us a horrendous depression of that magnitude. And in fact, it's on the basis of that psychological implication that people like Dr. Hobler and Lionel Robbins finally discarded the Austin theory, and that they no longer believe it, because you couldn't explain the depth and length of the Great Depression by the amount of adjustments that preceded it in the 20s. Those amount of adjustments were quite big, weren't that big? Well, that's illogical, isn't it? In other words, a big boom means that the needed, the necessary liquidation is going to be more than if you had a small boom. But it doesn't mean that even more trouble beyond the liquidation that's needed will have to be explained by even more misallocation during the boom. You get the point. In other words, when other things intervene and make the situation much, much worse than it otherwise would have been, much, much longer than it otherwise would have been, then you don't have to attribute those to the same causes that caused the downturn in the first place. So I think I want to abandon my PowerPoint and see if I can see you here. See if I can just black in my screen. It's an easy way to do that. And I want to talk to you about the kinds of things that went on during the depression, some of which will be familiar to you, maybe others won't. One contribution that Murray Rothbard makes is to let us know that Herbert Hoover wasn't the laissez-faire that he sometimes made out to be. And he had policies that he implemented right away when the downturn started that made matters much worse. And one of them goes by the name of a high wage policy. The government maintained a high wage policy in the face of tremendous drops in demand and downward pressure on prices and wages. So the market was putting downward pressure on prices and wages. But rather than let the market adjust, he maintained a high wage policy. And his policy was implemented in part by threatening any contractors that had contracts with the government and using those contracts if they reduced their wages. And while the government didn't have nearly as many contracts at that time as they do now, that had an effect. He also suggested that the firms engage in sharing the work as opposed to reducing wages. So unemployment or partial unemployment emerged as a result of this. This was a very counterproductive thing to do if you want the market to adjust to the new conditions and want it to liquidate where it needs to. Also, 1930 was the year that the Smoot-Hawley tariff was passed. There's always lots of political support for keeping out foreign competition anytime the economy is in trouble, because it causes a tremendous amount of problem in reducing trade and added to the unemployment problems. Hoover signed the bill into law in June, I think it was, in 1930, adding to the problems. When Roosevelt became president, it wasn't that he didn't reverse policy, he just approached it with a little more verve. He just went well beyond what Hoover had imagined doing. And let me mention some of the things that Roosevelt did in his first 100 days that had devastating effects on the economy. I might first say that he didn't have any kind of a coherent view about what ought to be done. He had a very pragmatic view. Let's try one thing. If it doesn't work, let's try something else. It's hard to claim it was driven by any kind of ideology. It wasn't systematic enough to be called ideology. one of his efforts at the beginning is, for instance, it's more amusing than anything else, is that he had a give a man a job program, and it was mostly jawboning and PR, trying to get people, get firms to hire more people. Just do it, and you'll be happy you did, because it'll generate income and spending power and make things more profitable. One of the things that I'll suggest that you do, just for fun, if nothing else, is that in those early days, he had a big PR program that included some shorts at the movies. You had the little short subject before you saw the feature movie. And one in particular was done by Jimmy Graney. Are people in here old enough to know who Jimmy Graney was or who Bob Jimmy? Yeah, you know. Jimmy Graney was an old Bob Dylan. His last appearance was in it's a mad, 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 mad world. He was the guy that kicked the bucket at the beginning and so on. He's an old Bob Dylan. He was hired by the NRA to chart Roosevelt's Give a Man a Job program. And if you go on to Google, this is an archived film that's recently available on the internet. Go to Google and Google Jimmy Durante and give a man a job in NRA. And it will pop up this video, about a 3-minute video, where Durante is doing a vaudeville act showing give a man a job, interviewing people in the audience, admonishing them to hire people. You look like a banker, who's your chauffeur? The guy says, I don't have a chauffeur. He says, well, don't drive yourself, hire a chauffeur, give a man a job. And it goes on to the next thing, it's the same kind of shit. I played it in my class at Macro, and the students thought it was some kind of a Saturday Night Live speech from the 30s. They said, no. This guy was working for the NRA. Okay, so he did some things that didn't work at all, and mercifully so. They were mercifully toothless policies. But immediately began doing things that did work, and I'll tell you about some of those. He had a Blue Eagle program. It was all part of the NRA, National Recovery Administration, in which the government specified prices to be charged in stores, and they were minimum prices. You have to charge at least so much for all these goods and services. And if you adhered to the price recommendations, which were all too high, people couldn't pay because they lost their job. Prices were falling, wages were falling. They couldn't afford to pay Blue Eagle prices, but it was unpatriotic not to charge Blue Eagle prices. Businesses got to have the Blue Eagle pasted to their storefront window. And Roosevelt, in his fireside chat, would admonish people not to shop at prices that didn't destroy the Blue Eagle. Alright? So there was a tremendous effort to keep prices from falling. In other words, it wasn't all paying things. The prices are sticky downwards, and inherently sticky. They were spot my own, okay, with the Blue Eagle, with the Blue Eagle program. There are stories in one book that was enjoyable read, Jim Powell, have you read it? The Follower, FDR Follower, I think it's called. One of the things he talks about, which I think clears up one issue for me, that if you hear people from the times of the Great Depression, they're coming around these days, they talk about what a magnetic, almost hypnotic voice that Roosevelt had when he talked to people on the radio. It was just mesmerizing. And they would tell him, he would tell them, don't shop in stores that had the Blue Eagle. And you wonder, did he really have this kind of a mesmerizing voice? Well, no, but it turns out that what does explain it is that, radio broadcasting started only in the early 20s. And by the time Roosevelt took office, it wasn't that old an industry. And politicians hadn't learned to use the radio. Our politicians were skilled at fooling. Here they go from farm to farm and stand on a big pile of manure and talk loud enough that several hundred people can hear. They orate. And when radio came along, if you put a radio microphone in front of their face, they would orate into the microphone. And it sounded pretty awful if you had the receiving set and you're listening to the microphone.
pretty awful. Couldn't the politician learn to just sit at his desk with a microphone in front of him and talk into it as if he were in the living room?
Yes. That's what Roosevelt learned to do. That's why he sounded, you know, it was just like having him in the living room. In other words, he wasn't orating into the microphone. He was just talking to the people. And they loved it. And they avoided stories that didn't display the blue eagle. Okay. So it was a tremendous effort. It was enforced, by the way, with literally tens of thousands of bureaucrats who would go around and check to see if you were charging blue eagle prices and try to buy things at less than blue eagle prices. And the shopkeeper wants to sell them to you because he can't unload them. But he can't. And if it turns out that you are an agent of the NRA, you rip out his blue eagle. And then he's done for you. It's an amazing thing. They had literally hundreds of thousands of civilian volunteers who loved Roosevelt and heard him on the radio. and mostly older women who would go into stores and try to buy things below blue eagle prices. And if they succeeded, you know, my husband lost his job, my son lost his job, we're hungry, we can't afford this, and the stuff is overflowing on the shelf anyway, but we can't unload it, you know. And so if the occasion is, okay, you know, sell it to you for a discount, then the old woman calls in the fan. She's a snitch, okay, loses his blue eagle. I mean, it's amazing how Roosevelt could pull that kind of thing. I don't think Bill Clinton could have pulled that off. But Roosevelt did it. And as you can imagine, doing things like that is tremendous time on the economy. How's the economy supposed to recover under those kind of circumstances? And everything was in surplus. Surplus this, surplus that, surplus that. And well, of course, because prices weren't allowed to fall to their market clearing levels. Now, of course, you had something else for all the surpluses. That is, the government would buy the surplus and pay the farmer or producer or whatever it was for it. Although, three short stories there that gives you the flavor of it, probably wouldn't mention them if there were exceptions, but they were not. They were the rule. Potato farmers were having trouble selling potatoes. Well, of course they were. People had trouble selling anything that had blue eagle prices. And the government orchestrated the burning of potatoes. The old history books used to have pictures of aerial pictures of burning mounds of potatoes. And Idaho farmers would come to a central location and build a potato mountain. You had to pour gas on it. Potatoes don't burn well without some gas on it. Okay. Pour gas on it, set fire to it, and it huge potato bonfire, which the farmers were paid for. They were paid for their potatoes. And of course, they never made it to the market because they were all burned. And this is a way of dealing with the surplus. Right? If you have sort of an economic bone in your body, you have an idea, well, that would keep prices up if you're going to ship the supply to the left. Okay? But then if you go beyond that, you say, well, would that really bring back prosperity or that patient recovery, well, really hard to see it. Also, it's potatoes. They happen everywhere. Pigs, literally millions of pigs, first grown pigs and then piglets were destroyed to take the pork surplus off the market. When they first initiated the program, they just slaughtered adult pigs, hogs. Paid the farmers for the hogs, because the hogs weren't paid, right? The farmers weren't paid. They got paid for the hogs. Eventually, they had kill every other piglet. So new piglets were born, they'd kill every other one. I don't know if it was the second, fourth, or first, and third, or whatever, but kill every other one. They were paid for it by the government, reduced the supply of pork, right? And of course, this shifted the supply of pork to the left and dealt with the surplus, but didn't bring back prosperity as you know it wouldn't. I remember an exam I gave several years ago I think I'm told in class that the federal government killed 5 million pigs. I think that's the number. It might be a little higher than that. But you know, we're not talking about a small program, 5 million pigs. And so, on the exam, I was partly an attendance taker. I asked, how many pigs did Roosevelt kill trying to get the economy out of a recession? He's a little blank there. And if you're in class, you know, 5 million. Okay. And then the next question was, how many more pigs would he have had to kill actually to get the economy out of the depression? one of the things came out during the talk, and he says, do you want a number here, or is this one of these talk questions? And I had, it was nice experience that I had one student who wrote, in Capital Block Writers, he wrote, you can't get out of the depression by killing pigs. He got it. One more story in that vein is that in the South, you could get, I mean, you know, you get the idea, you can apply it anyway. In the South, they crowd under the cotton. Any third row of cotton, they crowd under. And the government paid the cotton farmer for his crowding the cotton. At that time, of course, crowding was done by mule power. And if you had a good mule, he wouldn't walk on cotton. He knew bad things would happen to him if he walked on cotton. So good mules had learned to walk between the rows of cotton in crown. Okay. Now, if you actually wanted to plow under a row of cotton, you have to make the mule walk right down the row of cotton. And the mule wouldn't do it. And there was one editorial writer at a New Orleans paper that said the mules evidently had a little better understanding of economic reality than Roosevelt. Okay. But some farmers run their mules. In other words, they had to whip them even harder to get them to walk down the row of cotton. And that worked. But then when they won the quit plowing in the copper, you know, the mules, they just had mental problems. It didn't work that well. Again, these were the kind of losers that took the economy so long to to recover. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned, because it's controversial issue among the Austrians, and I intentionally didn't put it first because it's not the biggest issue, but it turns out that the money supply fell from the time of the crash turned to 33. This is what Milton Friedman emphasizes. The money supply fell by a third. And in fact, it's because the money supply fell that you had downward pressure on prices and wages. And of course, for that reason, it was crucially important not to keep them from falling. So you can't think of a more disastrous thing to have a government trying to prop up prices in the face of a decline in the money stock and therefore tremendous downward pressure on prices. That's a formula for disaster. But I would blame at least as much the propping up of prices as the falling of the money supply. And even the story about the falling of the money supply is a messy story, because at that time policy was made at the New York Fed. It wasn't made at the Board of Governors. And there was bickering among members of the New York Fed about what to do. They didn't know what to do. Because they didn't know what had happened. They didn't understand what they were dealing with. And it wasn't as if they were trying to do something and failed. They were bickering back and forth about what to do, plus a different opinion coming from the Board of Governors about what you should do. Plus, at that time, the Secretary of Treasury, that was Andrew Mellon, was an ex officio member of the Board of Governors. The U.S. Treasury used to be a member of the Board of Governors. And we had more ideas about what ought to be done. So, you know, in this atmosphere where the Fed couldn't find its feet and didn't know what to do, then the things that it actually did, while it increased the monetary base, it kept pumping in more reserves. But nonetheless, because of bank failures and excess reserve ratios and so on, the money supply collapsed. the main consequence of that is put down the pressure and then use the car. And if it weren't allowed to fall, then you got continuing depression. Let me mention one more thing, and then I want to open it up for questions. One blunder that we think not directly to see to the Federal Reserve, because the boom is caused by the Federal Reserve, was an episode in 37, actually 36 and 37, in a couple of pages, but I'll simplify the story. Thousands of banks failed during the early years of the Great Depression, and banks were extremely skittish, and as a result, they were holding reserve, that is, funds not went out, in much more volume than they needed time. The Federal Reserve imposes a required reserve ratio. They dictate to banks you have to have at least so much of your deposits not went out, and those are called reserves. And in normal times, banks will lend out all their allowance because that's how they earn their income. They collect interest on what they lend out. But in that period, the mid-30s, banks were also skittish. But they wanted a big, big cushion. So if there was a run on the bank, they could pay out the funds and still have the required reserves. Okay? And so banks everywhere, some to a greater extent than others, had excess reserves, huge excess reserves, to the point of about twice what they were actually required to hold. Understandable, I think. Now, the Fed totally misinterpreted it. And you can imagine the discussion at the Fed at the time. The main thing the Fed was concerned about was whether or not it was in charge, because they knew they were supposed to be in charge. We're the Fed, we're the central bank. We cause things to happen. If the money supply goes up, it's because we made it. If it goes down, it's because we made it. And yet, look what these banks are doing. They're holding all these excess reserves, which means that they could decide, without asking us, that's the key, they could decide to lower those reserves and expand the money supply on their own, without asking us. They can't have that because we're in charge. Okay? Now, they had a very poor understanding of why they were holding these excess reserves. And in the end, they decided, well, we don't know why they're holding them. We just don't want them to all of a sudden start growing in money. So we'll just double the reserve requirement. So they can keep holding those reserves, but never have to. We're back in charge. Can you imagine what happened? Well, the banks cut back on making loans to build up their reserves again over and above what was now required. And when they did that, of course, the money supply crashed. If you look at any chart that shows the Great Depression, whether it's showing output or whether it's showing employment or whatever, you see the economy coming out of the recession in 1937 and then, boom, back in for another 2.5 years because of that one hideous blunder by the Federal Reserve. This is one thing we can credit Milton Friedman with for analyzing that particular situation and showing what a blunder that was. And unfortunately, the example gets thrown up to the Austrians as evidence against their own business opportunity. Do people think that the crash in 37 was caused by elongation of the structure of production? No. That was just a bona fide blunder of the Federal Reserve in misunderstanding how bank reserves work. So the Austrians don't claim to have a theory that is extreme every up and down in the economy. They just explain how credit induced boom is inherently unsustainable. So once you see all of the history, one other thing I want to mention that sometimes is overlooked, and I almost overlooked it, was that during the 1930s, Roosevelt thought that ultimately it was the business community that was to blame for the Great Depression. He had a seething hatred for the business community. He thought they were the culprit, and they needed to be punished. And one of the ways he punished them was by instituting what we call at the time, it's descriptive, an undistributed profits tax. Now think about what this is. And it was a high tax up to 70%. Alright? Now, what do you mean by undistributed profits? Well, it means the profits that are retained, the retained earnings. Okay. So if you're a firm and you make some profits, you can distribute the profits to your shareholders and escape the tax. But if you keep it, if you keep a hold of those profits in order to plow back into the business and make it grow, then you're going to keep 30% because they pay 70% to the government. That's the profit tax. Now, if you know anything about business, you know that growth comes from retained earnings. That's the way funds grow. The retained earnings show you get bigger. And if the face of this talk, they're hesitant to even start a business. Why start a business? Because if you start a business, it's going to be small. And if you distribute all your profits, you're going to stay small. And if you try to grow with retained earnings, you're going to stay small because you're going to give 70% of the government. So that had a horrendous effect on the economy in keeping small businesses from starting and small businesses from growing. Okay, well, let me go here and we'll open it up for a few questions. Yeah.
What were the minds that
got us out of the plan?
What
were they saying? What got us out? Well, eventually they say it was the increase in the money supply for the purpose of financing World War II, essentially. This is one step removed in saying the war got us out. The thing that it was the increase in the monetary magnitudes. That's what the monetary can say, yeah.
So the question for this private capital number, what was the stock part of the depression?
Uh-huh. Well, he didn't have any answer. In fact,
what is he?
What is it? Well, it wasn't a shock. It was the inevitable consequences of trying to produce more than can be produced. You know what I'm saying? During the 20s, yeah.
What was the
No. In fact, when I deal head on with monetarism and Kamar's lecture and answers, whatever, I'll deal with that. But the brief answer is that the 1920s were a time of tremendous technological advance. There's all sorts of things going on between the 20s. Which in a market economy, if you don't have a central bank in place, actually causes interest rates to rise and businessmen more willing to pay a higher interest rate to take advantage of new technology. And the Fed was keeping interest rates from rising. So it was holding interest rates for longer than it would have been in a market economy. We'll talk about it. Yeah. Well, I mean, you probably heard that from Bob Higgs that wrote something like that. In other words, of course, his point was that no, it wasn't the war that got us out. In other words, you didn't want Roosevelt. Finally, that the economy recovered from the depression. Some of them were found unconstitutional. And then later came back peacefully. A lot of them we still have, like minimum wage and so on. Okay? A lot of them we still have. I'll leave it there. Yeah. Okay, I'll make it out. I'll put that on the next question. Okay, well, thank you very much. We'll go to the next one.